There were large influxes of immigrants who came to the United States in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. They mostly came from Europe and were looking to escape wars or to find more economic opportunities in a new country.
Immigration has continued since those early waves, but the numbers of people and where they've come from has changed in a lot of significant ways.
A new report looks at the demographic trends of foreign-born residents of Wisconsin and what their experiences have been. Malia Jones is an assistant scientist and social epidemiologist at UW-Madison's Applied Population Laboratory. She authored the report, which can be found on wiscontext.org. Malia, good to have you back.
Thank you.
So who falls under the heading of foreign-born residents?
When we talk about foreign-born residents, we're talking about anyone who was not born in the United States. And that can include immigrants who are here on a temporary visa, like a work visa or a student visa. It includes people who are here with no legal documentation, for example, those whose temporary visas expired. It also includes people who have legal permanent residency, so they're not U.S. citizens, but they have green cards or refugee status, and so they can stay and work here in the United States permanently. And then also a big part of this group is naturalized United States citizens. So they were born outside of the United States and moved here and then became citizens with voting rights and all the other rights and responsibilities of citizenship.
So here we are about 17 years into the 21st century. How different are the demographics that we're seeing now of foreign-born residents versus those previous historical waves of immigrants?
It is pretty dramatically different. In Wisconsin, historically, the immigrant streams, we had tremendous immigrant streams who came from European origins, especially Germany, Ireland, Scandinavia, those immigrant streams really tapered off a century ago. The part of history where Wisconsin had the largest number of immigrants was in 1890, when something like a third of the Wisconsin population were foreign-born. And today we see those European origins have really tapered off, and we're seeing much more diversity. People are coming in from Asia and Latin America in particular, and also continuing immigration from Europe.
It's not one of the big points in the report, but something that certainly caught my eye was, especially in those previous waves before air travel was really accessible or affordable, there was actually a category for people who were born on boats.
Yep, that's right.
And so where do they fall? Because they're not in their home country, but they're not being born here either.
This is a complicated question, it turns out. People who were born at sea are listed in the census, which is what we use for this report, in a separate category. And that's because their citizenship status is pretty hard to figure out. In general, if you're born on a ship or an airplane today, you are given the citizenship of the country where that vessel originated. But that's not
so
universal.
Different
countries do this different ways. It's changed over history.
How does the number and percentage of foreign-born people in Wisconsin compare to other states?
We have considerably lower foreign-born populations, smaller relative to our population size than lots of other states and the United States as a whole. In Wisconsin today, it's about 4.5% foreign-born, and that includes the 40% of foreign-born people who are citizens. Hmm. And in the United States, it's over 13% who are foreign-born. In some states, like traditional immigration destinations like California and Texas, it's much, much higher. California is almost 30% foreign-born.
So I'm guessing at least part of that is where we are located in the country. It's farther to go to get to Wisconsin.
It is. It's further to go. I think part of this has to do with the history of immigration and how porous the border has been over time. You know, it used to be fairly easy to cross the border between the United States and Mexico and come in from either Mexico or other origins in Central and South America than it is today. And that led to the creation of these historic streams where people, someone would come over, find a job in, say, in California in the fields, and then their neighbors and their cousins would come because they knew someone there. And it sort of creates this building migration stream.
We're talking with Malia Jones. She's an assistant scientist and social epidemiologist at UW-Madison's Applied Population Laboratory. And we're taking a look at new data that digs in on where foreign-born residents of Wisconsin have come from and in what numbers over several generations. So, Malia, we said that we have fewer number percentage-wise and sheer numbers of foreign-born people in Wisconsin compared to some other states. What about areas of Wisconsin? Are there areas where foreign-born populations tend to cluster?
Yeah, in general, immigrants to this country and to Wisconsin come for work opportunity, and so they end up in places where there are jobs. And in many cases, that means cities, manufacturing hubs, and then agricultural centers. And so people who came here for work, we see big clusters of foreign-born residents in Milwaukee, Madison, other urban centers in the state. And then we also have some clusters that happen in more rural areas, and those are related usually to some kind of either refugee resettlement program or an economic opportunity. So, for example, we have a large Somali cluster in Barron County, which is a fairly rural place. And those were refugees who were resettled there and took up in the meatpacking and processing industry in that area. And then, they sort of created the initial migrants. Refugees came in and created that settlement. And then, more Somali migrants came and settled in the same area and entered the same line of work.
How would you say that the undocumented foreign-born residents and those with legal status here differ in numbers and in the experience that they have?
The undocumented population, so these are folks who do not have legal permission to be in the United States. And I'm a demographer. The thing that is most striking from my perspective is we know hardly anything about them because they are very difficult to count. And so there are some estimates that were performed to figure out how many undocumented immigrants there might be in Wisconsin, found that about 1% of the total Wisconsin population, or about a third of all the foreign-born residents in the state, are undocumented. But truthfully, we don't know a lot else about them. We know that they come like other migrants. They come for work opportunities. They tend to be poorer. They have worse health outcomes, and they don't like answering surveys. So it's pretty hard to figure out. And I think in terms of experience, they don't want to answer surveys because of a fear of deportation.
So the undocumented residents have a different experience compared to those that are here with legal status. The foreign-born residents who have legal status, do we know how they fare compared to residents of Wisconsin that were born either in the state or at least in the United States?
Yes. So foreign-born residents who have legal documentation, who are here on some kind of visa or are naturalized citizens in the United States, they tend to have about the same levels of employment as native-born people from Wisconsin or elsewhere. They do tend to be somewhat poorer and have lower levels of health insurance. Those are data points that are on the census. And then the other thing that we talk about in this report, which I think is really interesting, and it speaks to the reasons people immigrate to Wisconsin. When you look at education, there's this really strong bifurcation. And we see a big group of people who come with very low levels of education, much lower than the state average for native-born residents. Those would be people who are coming for farm labor and manufacturing, food processing, working in the dairy industry. And those labor groups that really support our dairy and manufacturing economy. And then you also see a big group with very high education, and they're coming in highly skilled migrants to work in medicine, research, and other skilled fields.
And as we wrap up, Malia, do you have a sense of what future data on foreign-born residents in Wisconsin might look like?
Yeah, so if you look at the history of these trends, you can see that Wisconsin has followed the pattern of the U.S. in general, but it's lagged in terms of when those trends begin. So I think if we look at what's happening in other states right now, we'll see a little hint about the future of Wisconsin's foreign-born residents. And what we see is that we as a nation are increasingly dependent on foreign-born labor, especially in the low-skilled occupations. And so in traditional immigrant destinations, those migrant streams have increased as long as there are jobs to be had. And we'll see that in Wisconsin as well. We've already started to see it, and it will continue. And really, that's a good thing, because it means that if people are coming here for jobs, it means our economy is thriving and people are working and being productive.
Well, Malia, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Malia Jones is an assistant scientist and social epidemiologist at UW-Madison's Applied Population Laboratory. She joined us to share information from their new report about Wisconsin's foreign-born population, which you can find on wiscontext.org. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You may think of the Mexican presence in Wisconsin as a recent development, but people from Mexico and Mexican Americans from border states have been enriching our state's culture and history for over a century.
In a new book from the Wisconsin Historical Society, Sergio Gonzalez traces the stories of the individuals and groups that have been part of the Mexican experience in Wisconsin. He's a doctoral candidate in the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Department of History with research interests in American labor, immigration, and working class history, as well as the state's Latino community. Sergio, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You talk about the first Mexican resident of the state, Rafael Baez, who was an accomplished musician who came in the late 19th century and had quite a career in Milwaukee. But the first significant group of Mexicans came in the early 20th century. What brought them here?
They came looking for work. They came looking for new employment opportunities. In the late 1910s and early 1920s, there weren't as many opportunities in Mexico. With changes in immigration policy, federal immigration policy here in the United States, industrialists and agriculturalists in Wisconsin looked south for new labor force to bring to Wisconsin. Unfortunately for this labor force, they didn't know when they were recruited to come to Wisconsin that many of them were coming as strikebreakers. They were brought up to basically help break some of the larger unions in Milwaukee. And so the very initial experience upon arrival here in Wisconsin in the city of Milwaukee was that of individuals who were coming to take jobs, individuals who were coming to take away opportunities from Milwaukeeans.
Were there other areas of the state where they settled maybe for agricultural opportunities?
Absolutely. So the first large groups that come to Milwaukee are actually following in line with other migrants. Migrant laborers had been coming to Wisconsin throughout the 1910s, and many of them had been recruited to work in the beet industry. In Spanish, they're called betabeleros, which is beet pickers. And they were following the paths of Eastern and Russian Europeans who had come before them. As those immigrant groups started to settle out of the migrant streams, Mexican descent individuals would replace them. And throughout the 1910s and 1920s, sometimes there were solteros, there were solos, but sometimes there were families as well, because usually migrant work was a family industry where everyone had to contribute to help provide for the family.
The agricultural season isn't through the winter here. So were they going back either to southern states or to Mexico itself?
Right. So in the 1910s and 1920s, they would absolutely follow the migrant stream. And so they would come up during the planting season. They would travel to a different farm for another planting season because, of course, agriculture moves in different steps throughout the year. And then they would travel back for the harvest season. But at the end of the harvest season in fall, most of them would go back either to the southern parts of the United States or to find other agricultural work where the weather was more temperate.
So what was the next wave after that initial wave in the 1910s and 1920s? When did we next see a large influx of Mexican workers and residents?
So the Great Depression decimates the state's Mexican descent community. In Milwaukee, by 1929, there were nearly 7,000 Mexican descent individuals, families living in Milwaukee, had settled themselves, had begun to incorporate themselves into the city in some way. But the Great Depression completely decimates that community. From 7,000, by 1935, it's closer to 1,500.
Wow.
Some of them leave voluntarily, repatriate themselves to go back to Mexico to look for opportunities. But others are forced to leave. They're deported by local institutions who are looking to relieve the welfare rolls throughout the 1930s. And Mexicans are seen as both surplus labor, but they're also portrayed by the local media and by institutions as being saps on those welfare institutions. And so the community is decimated. And again, it's not until World War II that we see a regrowth of the community. And the pull, again, is labor.
often immigrants settle where their fellow countrymen and women are. Was that also the case for Mexicans?
It is. Their decision to settle was very much determined by where their employment was. And so the initial groups that came to Milwaukee settled on the near south side, around the tanneries, the foundries, the factories that they were working at. Their neighbors were often the European groups that they were replacing at times in the factories, or they were working side by side. To this day, the near south side of Milwaukee continues to be the predominant Latino part of town. And it's pretty impressive that over 100 years, the heart of that community continues to be in that initial place of settlement.
Sergio Gonzalez is a doctoral candidate in the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Department of History. He's the author of a new book titled Mexicans in Wisconsin. And as you just said, Sergio, the Mexican residents were living alongside the earlier waves of immigrants, often from Europe. Religion seems like it was a real bridge between those new Mexican residents and the communities that they were moving into. Can you give us some examples of that?
It's unfortunate that in many of the other social spaces, educational spaces, Mexicans found themselves discriminated against. But within the church, they found a sort of sense of shared fellowship. It was an understanding of a shared Catholicism, a shared religiosity that brought people together. So the most important story begins at the Holy Trinity Church, which is actually one of the oldest Catholic churches in Milwaukee. Mexican immigrants begin arriving at the church in the 1920s, and the white Catholics at the church look at them and say, these are individuals who can't understand our Mass, but they're Catholic like us, and they're here to praise the Lord. And so the decision was made within the white community to begin outreach efforts to the Mexican community. And working together, they developed their own independent Mexican mission chapel, which is now Our Lady of Guadalupe Holy Trinity Church. And throughout the 20th century, the church has continued to be a place where not all bridges have been built, but at a minimum, it's a space for imaginations to be kind of recreated, for different possibilities to be imagined.
You did say, and this has certainly been the case with other immigrants who are the latest arrivals, that there is friction often with the established communities that are from different ethnic backgrounds. And like other immigrant groups, Mexicans set up their own community centers and also mutual aid groups. What was the purpose, especially of those mutual aid groups?
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because the mutual aid societies in many ways mimic those that their predecessors had created. The two famous ones in Milwaukee in the late 1920s, La Sociedad Mutualista Hispano-Azteca La Sociedad Emilio Carranza, organizations that celebrate ethnic pride. They celebrate a cultural heritage that is not represented in other spaces in Milwaukee. In other spaces in Milwaukee, Mexicans are told that they need to speak English to integrate into the community. They're told that they have to adopt American customs to be truly accepted. But even when they do those things, Mexicans find themselves still outside the boundaries of acceptance in Milwaukee. And so they make the decision to create these institutions as a way to celebrate their heritage, but also as a place to pull back and to build community within themselves. And so they do everything from celebrating fiestas to celebrating religious traditions to setting up banking institutions. Everything that you could think of, they try to do on their own because they can't find the ways to do it in other places.
One difference that stood out to me is that early arrivals were Mexican nationals, but later waves were actually made up by a lot of U.S. citizens of Mexican descent who had probably been living in some of the border states. Were those groups treated differently? Did the existing communities in Wisconsin think of Mexican nationals versus U.S. nationals who were Mexican differently?
In some ways, yes. So the shift really occurs in 1947 when the state's agricultural industry looks towards Texas as its base for recruiting labor. And beginning in 1947, for the next decade, more than 10,000 Tejanos, or Texas Mexicans, make their way to Wisconsin every single year to work in agricultural fields. But unfortunately, they find many of the same barriers that Mexican nationals had faced before them. They faced segregation and discrimination in places as far-fetched as Door County and Waupun, just as Mexican nationals had faced in Milwaukee in the 1920s. Their calls for a sense of citizenship, in other words, that their legitimacy was based on their American citizenship in the country, sometimes was not actually met with reality. And so they faced many of the same barriers. And by the 1960s and 70s, we really do see a cross-national, cross-documentation movement building in places like Milwaukee, where these communities say, regardless of our documentation status or our residency status, we're facing many of the same issues.
As we start to wrap up, I do want to move forward to the last few decades and touch on Chicano activism. First, Sergio, can you tell us what Chicano means?
It's a political identity. It's a cultural identity. In the 1960s and early 1970s, young Mexican-Americans or people of Mexican descent began to try to reclaim a sense of who what their cultural heritage was. And it was often in defiance of a normative culture that meant to assimilate them into a larger society. And what they claimed is that their linguistic heritage, their cultural heritage, their historical background was important and needed to be not only preserved but celebrated. And so the identity of Chicano is a cultural and a national identity that grew in the 1960s.
You touched on some of the early topics that were of interest to Chicano activists. What are some of the issues now that have continued through over decades?
Fundamentally, the questions that confront people of Latin American descent and specifically Mexican descent in our state are the same ones that people in the 1920s faced, which is, how do I create a sense of belonging in this space? How do I find a sense of community in a space that has often recruited me to come here for work, that needs my labor, that needs my population growth, and yet denies me the space in my communities? And so we see a series of anti-immigrant laws, both at the state house and at the federal level. And if we look back in history in the 1920s and the 1950s and the 1970s, people of Mexican descent faced similar issues. And their claims are the same. I have come here to build a life for myself. You have told me that I'm a part of your community, and I desire to be a full member of that.
Sergio, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Sergio Gonzalez. He's a doctoral candidate in the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Department of History and is the author of a new book from the Wisconsin Historical Society Press titled Mexicans in Wisconsin.
Cooking is a family endeavor for celebrated chef Jacques Pepin and his granddaughter. They have a new cookbook out. It's called A Grandfather's Lessons in the Kitchen with Shori. And it's filled with family recipes that are unique and accessible for cooks of all ages.
Jacques Pepin joins us now along with his granddaughter, Shori. Jacques and Shori, bienvenue à Central Time.
Oh, merci beaucoup.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
So, Jacques, we'll start with you. Why did you want to write a cookbook of recipes that you've made along with your granddaughter?
Well, it started, not long after she was born. She started being in the kitchen with me, helping. She had a little box standing on top and giving me things and tasting food for me. Of course, now she's taller than I am, but actually we decided to do a series of little tape together doing recipe that we like to do. She loved chocolate or any type of dessert, and we didn't even want to do a book. And Claudine, my daughter, Shore's mother, say, oh, you got to do a book with that. So we did that little book. And actually, in the book, there is about 70 recipes, but there is 36 of those recipes are DVD, you know, where you can access. If you want to know how it's done, then you can see Shore and I making the recipe. You know.
Yes, yeah, so you just go online on Sur la Table, and there are the sets of videos that we made for some of the recipes.
You can see that Shori has a different accent than me because I live in Connecticut and she lives in Rhode Island.
Yes, we could hear that Connecticut accent.
Yeah, right. Shori, what are some of your earliest cooking memories?
Well, I've been eating with my grandfather and my parents my whole life, all this good food. But I think I started really cooking with him when I was about 6 or 7. It was for the Essential Pepin series, and I did stand on a box.
And Shori, you know, it's funny when you know someone who's famous, but you know them from an early age, you don't necessarily realize that they are well known and that they are well respected. Do you remember when you figured out, hey, I think Pepi is maybe a bigger deal than I thought?
Honestly, I don't think I've really figured it out yet. When I was younger, I just thought of him as my grandfather, and people were always asking me what was it like to have him as my grandfather, and I was like, what do you mean? You know, he's my grandfather. So it's hard to take in that people think of him in that way.
And Jacques, yes. I want to get into the cookbook, A Grandfather's Lessons, and going through the recipes. I mean, from the title, some of them sound like they're going to be fancy and complicated. These all seem doable, even for someone like me. Was that what you were shooting for in this cookbook?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I always like to simplify food. I've done it. I think this is book number 32 for me. So, but I even simplify it further with this. I wanted her to be able to do it. I wanted her to have fun. And, you know, with a kid, it starts, when she was very tiny, going to the garden, take her to the garden. And her father is a chef as well, so they have a big garden. Go get me some tarragon. No, this is chive. No, this is parsley. And then even going to the market with me, you know. And I tell her, go get me some pear. Make sure, smell them, make sure they are ripe or whatever. So the kid, you know, have to handle, touch the food, and be in the kitchen with you just for fun. And, you know, in the cooking together, we bring a lot of other things in there. For example, you know, we'd have a tomato. I say, well, is a tomato a fruit or a vegetable? Where does it come from? Or whatever. Or then I ask her, give me 3 tablespoons of butter. How many tablespoons you have in that stick? How many stick in a pan? How many tablespoons in that glass of milk? So we bring mathematics in it. We bring all kind of things through food, you know.
So Jacques, I think one of the things that is different between France and the U.S. is that there is a long tradition of home cooking in France that continues to this day. Certainly, some convenience foods have been introduced, but I think there's a fair number of American parents who would like to get in the kitchen with their kids, but they don't actually feel like they have the skills to pass along. Do you think this book would be good for them, too?
Yes, absolutely. You know, it can go. I mean, look, for example, I do a chicken there. I can, of course, home, I roast a chicken most of the time, but I wanted to show her. We were at the market, and there was nice chicken coming out of the rotisserie. I said, let's get a chicken. I'll show you something. I bought some nice Boston lettuce. I love Boston lettuce. Any lettuce would do. I spread them on a large tray, and then with a shear, we cut the chicken. And then in the skillet, I put some olive oil to a bit of a chopped onion or shallot, some garlic. We spread that on top of the cut chicken, a bit of lemon juice, and all of a sudden you make it your own, you know, so you transform it. We did another dish like that. I said, you want to do a cake for your mother for her birthday? I want to show you how to do it. So we buy a nice quality pound cake and a little jar of raspberry preserve. We heat the raspberry preserve in the microwave. I trim the pound cake all around. We put the trimming in the food processor to make crumbs. And then with two little pieces of wood, actually I use 2 ribs of celery now, one on each side of the cake. I can put the knife flat and show her how to slice the cake. It's not that easy, but that make a guide. And then we put jam on top of it. We put back the crumbs, and we have a beautiful little cake. I mean, anyone can do that.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Jacques Pepin and his granddaughter, Shori. Their new book is A Grandfather's Lessons in the Kitchen with Shori. I want to get into some of the recipes you've shared with us. Let's start with, these look wonderful in the picture, the cottage cheese pancakes. Can you tell us the story behind these, Jacques?
Behind that my wife who makes cottage cheese pancake, and Shori was there, and she said, oh, I love those pancakes. I said, okay, well, we're going to do a recipe then. And she wanted to serve it with blueberry. She loves blueberry. I think we put a little bit of apricot preserve with that, and they are very easy. They are done in a few minutes. Shori, have you done them home by themselves?
Yeah, we have actually done them once or twice. I really like having them for breakfast.
Good.
What does the cottage cheese add to the pancakes?
Well, moisture, a little bit of a different taste, you know, texture as well as moisture, and it's kind of light and relatively not too caloric, you know.
And you can actually see that recipe for the cottage cheese pancakes over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Shori, you know, you're growing up in the United States. There are kids who don't eat everything that comes to the table that adults are eating. They're eating fish sticks and chicken fingers and plain spaghetti. But you really grew up eating everything. And are you glad you did?
I mean, when I was growing up, there was no other option to not eat what they put in front of you. So my parents said, this is what we're having for dinner. I never had the idea to ask for something else. So that's, I think, is a big reason why I didn't grow up picky. And I'm definitely glad that I haven't grown up that way.
But now that you're grown up, is there any option?
No, there's not.
There is no.
Oh, but that said, there are recipes for spaghetti and hamburgers and mac and cheese. A lot of the basic things we think of as kid foods, you've got versions of in the cookbook, Jacques.
Yes, we even have a curly dog.
You know? That's right. That looked great.
I used to work for Howard Johnson many, many years ago. I was in the test kitchen, so we used to produce at the commissary tons of hot dog, you know. So I used to fool around with them, putting them in soup or with sauerkraut or with all kind of thing. And one day, I don't know why we came out with that idea of cutting them so they kind of curl up. So, you know, some of the recipes are fun, but I mean, we did a little pickling things to put on top, and you add that on half a hamburger bun, and it's a great recipe. It's fun.
We're talking with Jacques Pépin and his granddaughter, Shori, about cooking in the kitchen as a family. They have a new book out right now called A Grandfather's Lessons, In the Kitchen with Shori.
And you can join the conversation over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Do you cook with your kids or your grandchildren? How did you get them interested in the kitchen? Was there an adult who got you into the kitchen at a young age? What did you like to prepare when you were young? Share your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're continuing our conversation with Chef Jacques Pépin and his granddaughter, Shori. They're with us to talk about tradition and cooking through the generations. They have a new cookbook out called A Grandfather's Lessons, In the Kitchen with Shori. In it, they share family recipes and stories.
And you can join the conversation. What are some of your favorite recipes to cook with your kids or grandkids? If you grew up cooking with your parents or grandparents, what did you learn? Do you still make some of those recipes now? Share your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
And Jacques and Shori, let's talk about your tomato soup recipe. And Jacques, the way you introduce it, it sounds like tomato soup is a base that you can turn into just about anything you want.
Yes, actually, you know, it's a tomato soup, but you can make a sauce for pasta with it. You know, you can add it to a stew. You can do all kind of thing. You can serve it hot. You can serve it cold. You can serve it lukewarm. You can serve it with the cream or without the cream. You can serve it with herb from the garden. Very often, if we have, of course, or not only tarragon, but certainly basil, we would put that on top. Yes, so it's a kind of very versatile recipe.
Is that a favorite of yours, Shori?
I love tomato soup. I have grown up eating it. So, yeah, this really tastes like home.
Let's bring on a caller now. Tim is with us in Madison. Tim, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Tim?
Well, I just used to watch the Essential Pépin show all the time, you know, on PBS. And I just love to watch this young granddaughter interact with her grandfather. It was especially enjoyable. And I love the chocolate, as you mentioned before. I can remember those series, but I just was curious to know from each of them if they have any particular memory doing that series together, if anything, you know, stands out for them.
Well, I remember you step on that little box too, and we had chocolate, and I said, test it. You put your finger to it, I push your finger in it. Then after you add it on your face, on your lips. I don't do that with you anymore.
No, I remember I had chocolate on my face like the entire episode, and I watched it just recently, actually, and I was like, what was I thinking? Why didn't anyone get that off of my face?
Yeah. But you know, okay, 6 years ago, that's 6-7 years ago, and for me, who passed 80 years old, it's not that long ago, but for you, it's half of your life, right?
Yeah.
And did you have favorites of what you made on that show?
Do you?
I actually really liked that recipe with the graham crackers and the chocolate on the inside.
Graham cracker, yes.
That was probably one of my favorites.
Thanks for that call. And next we have Mary Beth calling from New Berlin. Hi, Mary Beth.
Hi there. I wanted to thank Jacques for something that I learned while watching one of his shows that has just become a family favorite for us. He made a swan out of a melon and then put cut fruit in it, and it's just such an elegant presentation for fruit, and I do that so often, and my family loves it. Thank you so much.
Oh, good. Well, thank you very much. It's already rewarding for me to have, you know, people should look at a recipe and try to do it just the way it is, at least the first time. If it comes out good, you're likely to do it again. Second time, you take a faster look. By the third, fourth time, you, quote, improve the recipe. you want more tomato in it, or you want cook it shorter, or whatever. And a year later, you don't remember where it come from, and it has become your own recipe. You kind of massage it to your sense of taste, to your sense of aesthetic. And I think it's something which is gratifying to me when people do that.
Thanks so much for that call, Mary Beth. And Jacques, I want to ask you a question. There's a photo at the beginning of the cookbook, and you and Shori are in the kitchen together, and you are dipping a balloon in chocolate. And yes. I want to know what you're doing there.
Well, we dip the... You want to explain that? Okay.
So we melt down the chocolate in the microwave, and you have to make sure to not scorch the chocolate. You can't do it over 40 seconds. And then you take the balloons and you blow them up and you sort of roll them in the chocolate. And then you put them in the fridge.
Inflated balloon.
Right.
Inflated,
inflated.
Yes.
Yeah. And you roll them in the chocolate. You put them in the fridge and let the chocolate harden. And then afterwards, you can pop the balloons to take them out. And you have this beautiful chocolate goblet that you can put mousse or whipped cream or something. And it's a really nice presentation.
Strawberry, raspberry.
Yes, fruit.
Whipped cream.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say I've done a lot of these Food Friday segments. This is the first time I've seen a recipe include 4 latex balloons.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yes. No, don't put any mashed potato in it.
No.
Well,
speaking of chocolate, one of the recipes you shared with us, I want to make sure we get into. We've got this on the Ideas Network Facebook page, the chocolate, nut, and fruit treats recipe. Jacques, tell us about that one.
Yes, this is very, very easy. Again, you melt your chocolate in the microwave oven, and you take those tiny little paper cup, you know, about 3-4 tablespoons big, it doesn't really matter. And then you pour about 2 tablespoons of the value of melted chocolate in it, and before it hardens, then you garnish the top. You embed into the soft chocolate, you embed any type of nuts you want, walnut, hazelnut, almond,
fruit.
Pistachio, and then a fresh fruit, you cut pieces, dry fruit, dry cranberry or whatever, even a little piece of mint, you know, we put, and then you put that in the refrigerator 15-20 minutes, it hardens, you remove the paper cup, and you have beautiful little dessert, which you would spend a fortune in a restaurant to have.
We are talking with Jacques Pépin and his granddaughter, Shori, and I want to point out something that's in this cookbook, very simple recipe, but a very French recipe to me, which is radishes with butter. And whenever I have radishes with butter, people here look at me a little funny. What is so great about radishes with butter? Shori, why don't you take that one?
Well, I think that since radishes have a really strong flavor, obviously they're kind of spicy, the butter sort of complements that. And I think that if you put like butter and salt on it, it's just the flavors, they go really well together. So
yeah, with a good baguette, though.
Yes.
We also, I'm sure you have seen, instruction on folding napkin, on setting up the table. We have instruction on table manner, which Shori loved to do because I was the guinea pig. And she told me, don't slouch, don't put your elbow on the table, don't speak with your mouth full, don't interrupt me, bring the spoon to your mouth, so forth. So
no,
she had
slurping.
A good time correcting me. Yes, right.
So, Shori, what do you recommend to kids who might want to start cooking but really don't know where to start? Maybe their parents don't know where to start.
Well, I think that if you want to start cooking as a kid or as an adult, you should just find like something that you enjoy eating and find a simple recipe for it and then just try and make it. I mean, there's not much that can go wrong. My friends and I, we sometimes try and make food together, and it's usually more about the process of actually making the food instead of the outcome, because it's not always so great.
Yeah, the process also of going to the garden, if you have one, and even if you don't have one, going to the market, bring the kid to the market, make them pick up the strawberry, the fruit, and so forth. I mean, frankly, you know, at my age, how do you communicate to a kid who's 12 years old? She's very fast with her iPad and iPhone, much faster than me. But then at least we have a common ground here. We can talk and eventually, you know, talking in the kitchen, and we talk around the table, and that's, I think, very important. So the kid has to get involved from day one. I don't think I ever made baby food for Claudine when she was small. We just had a, not a cuisinier. At the time, it was a blender, yes, starting. So anything we ate, I put in the blender, short of not to season. And she would have that as a puree. So meaning that by the time the kid is 8 years old, if you do, spaghetti and cream sauce, well, they know that taste because they probably had it as a puree when they were small, you know.
And Shori, my kids are about your age, and they're not fussy eaters, but there's a lot of stuff in the book that I don't think they would eat if I put it in front of them. Do you encounter that as you meet your peers? They look at what you're eating and they're like, what? What is that?
I think I actually have a really good group of friends. Okay. They're all very diverse, but in my school, there are probably many people who are not as open to new ideas and unfamiliar foods like that. So, yeah, I understand.
And Jacques, there are some really lovely little line drawings, besides wonderful photos in this book, and I understand that those are yours.
Yes, not only the drawing. You can see on the first open page, I have the drawing of one menu that I did, and Shori did the other one. So after 51 years of marriage, I have 12 books of menu. This way, you know, that we've done when people come at home. My whole life, you know, is on this. I can see my mother signing in there, my two brothers. I can tell you what Claudine, my daughter, asked for her fifth birthday. Mm-hmm. So this is the habit that we do at the house that, Shori, you do at your house also now.
Yeah.
And you do the drawing.
I think we have one book and then one in progress. So it's a little bit of a newer tradition in our house right now. But, yeah.
Wow. So it's like a historical family scrapbook of meals.
Yes, and you don't even have to do a drawing. Take a book and record, you know, the holiday, certainly the birthday, all of that type of stuff. When special guests come, you can also look at them and say, those people had dinner here 3 years ago. What did we serve them? Mm. So you don't serve the same thing. Or maybe you serve the same thing.
Maybe they really liked it and they want the same thing.
So, Shori, as we wrap up, if you had to make something for a big party this weekend, what would be your go-to dish in our last few moments?
I would definitely make, like, just roast chicken and a salad. It's simple, it's clean, and almost everyone likes it. I've never met a person who doesn't like roast chicken, so.
And Jacques, what are you going to be making whenever you get back home to Madison, Connecticut?
Ooh, fish probably. I mean, the Arctic char for me with a fresh tomato, that's very good. My wife loves fish, so, yeah, that type of thing.
Well, Jacques, Shori, merci beaucoup. We really enjoyed having you with us.
Merci bien.
Merci.
Merci. Merci. Au revoir. A bientôt, j'espère. That was Jacques Pépin and his granddaughter, Shori. Their new book is A Grandfather's Lessons in the Kitchen with Shori.
And you can find three of the recipes from that cookbook and try making it at home. They're all pretty easy and approachable. What do we have? The pancakes?
We have cottage cheese pancakes.
Soup.
Tomato soup and chocolate
fruit
nut.
And nuts.
Yes.
Yeah. So you can find that all on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And if you have a favorite Jacques Pépin memory, you can share it there as well. Again, that's on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Just visiting with Jacques Pépin, and a lot of us remember watching him cooking alongside Julia Child. There's actually a new book out about Julia and Paul Child's early years in France.
It's mainly a photo book. The images are taken by Paul Child, who is quite an artist, apparently. Many of them were taken on their traditional afternoon walks in Marseille and in Paris. Paul was in the Foreign Service, and they were stationed in both of those cities.
And for me, the ones of Julia really give you a look at her before she was the Julia Child that we all know and love. And it's really touching to see her through her husband's lens early in their marriage.
Yeah, and with the book and with the conversation we just had, it is really, you know, you've got this legendary, right, chef you see on the TV, and but getting this personal glimpse behind the scenes at what they're like in their daily lives with members of their family in both of these cases, it is a different lens, literally, in the case of the photo book.
Well, and it's funny because Julia was very tall. She was a large woman, and these photos, I mean, you don't get the feeling that she's a petite woman, but it really brings out this inner beauty of her, and that I think she didn't always necessarily feel was there.
We'll put up a link to an article that includes some of those pictures. You can find it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.